Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. What has been called the best-known violin concerto in the world, the best-loved, most easily recognized, all of these apply to the violin concerto by Felix Mendelssohn. And Arkansas audience next weekend will certainly be caught up in it from the opening measures. The soloist, Kirill Laskarov, is the Arkansas Symphony's concertmaster. He is from Bulgaria, where he received his training up to his bachelor's degree from the State Academy of Music in Sofia. In 1995, he won the Bulgarian national competition, and all that implied, before moving to America, where he earned his master's degree from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. He was brought to Arkansas by then maestro David Itkin to be one of the newly established co-concertmasters, so he is now in his 17th year. His connection to the Mendelssohn work go back to his student days.
I was fortunate to win the Bulgarian national competition in 95, my last year of undergraduate college in Bulgaria. So I was offered a year of performances, so I got to perform with some local orchestras for a while, which was a great experience.
Yes.
And the Mendelssohn was one of the pieces I could perform.
My
mom, who keeps records of each and every performance, actually found out that I had performed this piece about 7 or 8 times, including a performance in Athens, Greece, with the National Youth Symphony Orchestra.
So what would be the most recent one prior to this one that's
coming up?
The most recent
performance was in Las Vegas with the Philharmonic in September 2007.
Was that with David Itkin?
With David Itkin. That was his opening season in, and he invited me to perform that piece with him. And I've been wanting to do this piece for a while. Mm-hmm. I've never performed in my hometown now, Little Rock. And when the maestro approached me last year about performing a piece, I suggested this one, and I was hoping he would say yes, and I really appreciated the fact that he did.
Well, it fits in with his making Mendelssohn the composer of the year. So
yes,
that worked out fine.
Quite true. And
I know that you have other engagements playing with other orchestras, and you have a following of a lot of people who want to hear you when you're a soloist. And you're so used to the solo parts you play in the various concertos or regular symphonies that...
Or great orchestral pieces, Scheherazade comes to mind.
Yes.
I've had the pleasure of performing with you.
Yes.
Great pieces. As you know, Mendelssohn is the darling of the violin concertos, and every student wants to learn it, every professional wants to play it, every conductor that I've known likes it. It could be performed with any style, from late classical to romantic to...
And you never get tired of it. It's so joyous. It's such a wonderful piece of music.
For a very good reason, and the major reason for that, I think, it's easy to forget at times how original and even revolutionary that piece was at the time it was composed.
Explain that for my listeners and for me.
Couple of some really obvious examples. The famous opening. Mendelssohn really opens the door to the concerto with this haunting theme on E string, but he really opened a new chapter in music history with this first page. For the first time ever, it was the violin soloist who presented the theme. And the way it begins as though it had already started in the orchestra with a measure and a half, a technique that Bruch and Sibelius would use later in their concertos. Mendelssohn plays the cadenza in the middle of the first movement, removed it from its traditional place at the very end of the first movement, and thus made it the centerpiece of the first movement. And this is something that Tchaikovsky would take into his violin concerto later, expand this, and Sibelius even further, to the point when the Sibelius cadenza became the development section, the entire development section of the first movement. The very ending of the first movement is wonderful. As we move forward in space, the composer asks for faster and faster and presto, and he was known for conducting fast tempos.
Uh-huh.
In the meantime, we move back in time as we get to hear the connecting theme and then the very opening theme in the orchestra, a great dramatic effect.
So almost as though he skipped and went to the second movement before the first.
Yes, connected and performing all three movements, a tacco with no interruption, beautiful slow movement, song without words, last movement that might have come just out of Midsummer Night's Dream, composed only 2 years earlier, mm-hmm. with in the same key as the overture, the scherzo, the wedding march is pretty much a reference to the wedding march in the second theme. Great virtuosic ending.
So the soloist gets a chance to show off on all three movements.
Correct. And the first page is probably the most difficult in the concerto. Well, the last page is probably one of the easiest last pages in the concerto literature. It was just, that was designed for fun and joyous ending of the piece. But there is one other way I think this piece is so original that very few people might know about. So it's a known fact that Mendelssohn dedicated this piece to his friend and colleague Ferdinand David, the concertmaster of the Gewandhaus Orchestra, whom he invited to that position. But what many people might not know is that Mendelssohn not only actively sought feedback from David on the piece, but actually incorporated pretty much all of his suggestions into the score. And that is quite evident when comparing the original version of the piece to the revised version, which is known as the real piece now, and which is performed everywhere.
So you never hear the original as it was performed the first
time? You can hear it recently, most recently, the violinist Daniel Hope recorded both back-to-back. So one can really hear the differences. To me, that shows, on a smaller scale, the great respect Mendelssohn had for his friend and the violinist as well. Mendelssohn played the violin, so he really must have respected David tremendously to do all this. For example, Brahms would seek feedback from Joachim in this concerto, but he would not incorporate more than half of his.
So did Mendelssohn himself perform the work in concert near the time of its creation?
No. Mendelssohn could not even conduct the opening performance because he was sick at the time. He did conduct a performance later on. I think, to go even further, I think in a way Mendelssohn acknowledged for the first time in concerto music history that it does take two to create a great piece. It is the genius of the composer who creates the piece, but the need to have a great performer who breathes life into it, if you will. And by doing so, I think that is one of the major reasons this concerto avoided the fate of the Tchaikovsky and Sibelius concerto that had to be revised later on and took a while for them to be established in the violin repertoire.
Because what you had said about the cadenza and where it appeared and the influence it had on subsequent composers when they created concerti, particularly with the violin, because the tradition had been established that the cadenza was a chance for the soloist to show off.
Yes.
And that was one of the reasons it was left without any orchestra, so that they could do what they wanted to.
Exactly, and expected to improvise in the classical. But what is interesting, Mendelssohn, who was a concert pianist and was known for his great improvisations of other composers' cadenzas, works and writing his own, he did write this cadenza, and he expanded it at David's request, but he did notate each and every note in the cadenza, as though he wanted to make sure future generations will interpret it exactly the way he saw it. Although recently the violinist Joshua Bell composed his own cadenza to the piece.
Was it well received?
Yes, quite well received, but it's debatable whether that could be done or one should just perform the cadenza described with the composer. So.
Well, the other day I was listening to KLRE and the announcer, wasn't a performance today or anything like that, said this, we will get to the most famous violin concerto in the world.
Very, very, very true. Quite, it's performed a lot, recorded so many times, which again brings me back to your first question. If I could only ask for one thing, hope for one thing that night, Saturday night and Sunday afternoon, is for our friends in the audience to try to hear this piece with fresh ears, the way people must have heard it on that chilly winter night in 1845, to be able to truly appreciate how original this piece was at the time.
Well, I think that this is a sort of work that Philip Mann knows the history and would be as fine a conductor for this particular desire of yours to work with the composer. And then, of course, touching briefly, you're going to be working with an extraordinary violin.
Yes, briefly. I'm fortunate, I'm blessed to have been given the opportunity to perform the piece on this wonderful instrument and loaned to me until the end of the second performance. This is the 1712 Lebrun Stradivarius, one of the golden period strats that began around 1708. with a wonderful, magnificent, absolutely magnificent instrument, with, sweet and powerful, brilliant in the high register with rich, velvety sound on G-string. Great instrument that allows a good violinist to play with effortless virtuosity. Maestro and I were talking about this recently. We both like Roger Federer, tennis player. So watching Federer play with utmost precision and yet making it effortless, that's exactly what it feels on a good day to play such a great instrument. And I hope I can do it justice as well.
Because my question, I think, is one that a lot of people have. How quickly can you adjust from a violin that you've been working with for years that's your own? There's a period where not only do you have to get used to the violin, new as it is, the violin has to get used to you.
Yes.
And the quality of meeting those two needs is what helps determine what will happen.
Correct. I have had the pleasure of working on this instrument for almost 3 months now, and our Masterworks patrons had already heard it without knowing it, and our Beethoven in Blue Jeans, when I had the pleasure in order to perform the solo in one of the movements of Swan Lake, and I used every minute possible to work, to explore this instrument, to enjoy, and it really is a joy. I end each of my practice sessions with the feeling that I've discovered more about the instrument, but not just about the instrument, about the piece I'm playing, and about my own playing as well. So I'm truly hoping that it will be a wonderful performance and our patrons will enjoy it.
With an instrument of that age and quality, do you have to have special strings for it?
I kept the setup exactly as it came to minimize any possible damage to the instrument. It is good to have powerful strings that would allow the soloist to project over the orchestra while maintaining good quality of the warm strings. So I guess the answer is yes, yes and no. I like to think that the personality of the instrument combined with the personality of the soloist and the conductor and the orchestra would allow it to experience, would all come together and contribute to your overall experience, make it a memorable evening when you really remember this evening as the night when the orchestra and our concertmaster performed this piece on the Strat. And this is something I know I will be remembering for the rest of my life.
That was violinist Kirill Laskarov, concertmaster with the Arkansas Symphony and soloist with his orchestra next weekend in Mendelssohn's much-loved Violin Concerto. Whatever Philip Mann, the Arkansas Symphony music director-conductor, plans for programs and performers that he brings to Arkansas for us to meet, these are always musical experiences that hold their own in any of the great concert halls. When he also introduced a few years ago the position of Composer of the Year, the first, Michael Torkey, and subsequent choices have added greatly to our musical horizons. Dan Visconti is this season's composer in residence, and he will be in Little Rock this week and next weekend. Born in 1982, he has such an incredible number and variety of works already commissioned by an equally impressive list of major artists and organizations. The very first work he composed, is paid for, and performed was a string quartet called Black Bend, which is now also orchestrated and which we will hear next weekend.
For that, let's see, I had, written a couple of works before then, but the first major work I wrote that was paid for and everything was a work for the Cleveland Museum of Art. And it was a work called Black Bend for string quartet that was based on some local legends around the Cuyahoga River and some photography. And it's very much a work that's inspired by a lot of popular forms, a lot of blues and folk music. So it was a very important work for me in that it was the first work where I started to look at taking influences from outside of the traditional classical canon, but finding ways to incorporate them in a thoroughly classical concert composition. So okay. I've only been writing about 2 years. So, I would say it was very early on, that was the first full form of that approach. And I think it's something I was dabbling at before, and Black Bend was the first piece where that all came together in a really coherent way. So I guess it was my first successful attempt. to come and share a piece that is just, you know, so close to my heart and so important for my development.
Now, are you from Chicago originally?
I went to school at Cleveland, at the Institute of Music, for my bachelor's and master's in 2000 to 2005. And I had a very brief stint at Yale in New Haven. And then I was just living and doing freelance work in the D.C. area until recently, about a year ago, I moved back to Chicago, which is now my permanent home. And I've done a lot of traveling. I did a year in Rome, a year in Berlin. So after Chicago, it was kind of a lot of different places until I finally came back.
There's something about it that if you're ready for it, it'll propel you almost without volition on your part.
Absolutely. You know, I think that there's so many great cities that one could work in, and I had a good chance to live or visit some of them. But what I really like about Chicago is that, you know, there's something about the Chicago scene, at least for music, that I found to be a lot more collegial. What's happening in the theater community in Chicago is a lot of artists trying to engage communities and to engage in civic practice projects where they actually work with the community to develop a work of art that addresses needs or concerns, as opposed to just writing a piece of, you know, theater or music and saying, well, this is about an issue thematically or something like that. So some of that is starting to influence music. And one of the things I do in Chicago is I'm director of programming for Fifth House Ensemble, which is a group in Chicago that's really devoted to a lot of these same kind of social mm-hmm. initiatives with music. So, you know, through Fifth House, which is the reason I moved back, I do a lot of work in the Cook County jail system, in the public schools, through arts integration, where we'll go in where programs have been cut and, you know, bring them back music and also weave music into different classes. Like you're talking about poetry, talking about meter and rhyme. Well, music is a great way to talk about that. Musical examples could be helpful. So there's a lot of things from the small and modest to the kind of very large and extravagant that I think music is able to accomplish for social purpose. And that's something that I see happening in Chicago now, and I wanted to be part of it.
So when you came back to Chicago, this was one of the projects or one of the areas that you saw yourself as not only being needed, but needing, because it'll give you so much to play with for sound, for story, for instruments, for...
Yeah, it's definitely a two-way street, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think there's so often the overtone of, like, well, save the children, which is great. Obviously, I'm doing this kind of thing because I want to make positive change, but I think you're very right that it also it benefits my creativity greatly. It connects me to experiences of people outside of myself and who often have different backgrounds and stories, and those stories inform my work. I grew up listening to all kinds of music, and I think, you know, like many people, one of the early musical loves was the music of the Beatles and George Martin. And what I love so much about that music, among many things, is that it's music that's incredibly daring and experimental and often way out there, right? But it's also music that's very accessible. It's very melodic. And I think a lot of times in contemporary classical music, there's almost this strange supposition that those two things have to be at odds, that there's music that pleases or at its worst panders, and then there's serious music, and you can tell how serious it is because the more inscrutable and the more obscure, the better. And although I can understand why there's impulses and certain truths in that, I think the big truth that I want to get across in my own music is that these seemingly disparate elements, they're all connected. And in my own work, I very rarely am self-consciously quoting or dropping something, and I think it's more that that popular music inflection mm-hmm. is part of my language, and just but it's definitely a piece that begins and becomes more bluesy, that starts to acquire the characteristics of like a blues big band, and then it moves away from that. So within a single piece, there's parts of that composition that sound more just like this wash of outdoor rural sounds, and then there's a part where those get assembled and it becomes more recognizable. And for me, it's often that subtle gradient between suggesting something and not, and moving and inching towards it. Those are things that interest me, the transformation and suggestion, more so than hitting people over the head with, hey, this is blues or this is rock. So I don't know if that gives some kind of explanation of my crazy thinking on the matter.
Well, I was just listening to you and I was thinking of the blues, and the blues are almost a bridge to any other kind of sound. It's got that melancholy and rhythm and imagination that it doesn't matter if it's fully within a classical piece or a jazz piece or a bit of folk music that you just feel you want to sit down in a club and play something.
Yes, I very much agree. You know, what's so great about the blues to me, is that it's a genre that, on its bare bones, it's very simple. It's just a very basic structure and a very limited number of chords, scales, or gestures. But within that, like a simple sandwich, that there's so much that one could do, that there's so many different shadings and styles, and actually sometimes more highly refined genres, although they may outwardly have more sophistication, they're actually very limited in the ways that they could be altered or bent and still retain their identity. So that's exactly why the blues is of such interest, and it's also been of so much use to my own composition, is that it's a particular feeling and a particular narrative and lyrical structure, but that it can really be approached and taken in so many different directions. I think it lends itself very well to further musical warping and experimentation.
You're right. Now, I wondered if there are times with the classical music that surrounds you pretty regularly in all kinds of areas, that you get an urge to jigger it a bit, to see what quotations that you can make it sound, work in new sounds and new shapes that you haven't yet experimented with. It's sort of hovering on your shoulder, thinking as you're writing something more within the classical formation, the classical, not necessarily demands, but acceptances of appreciation of what classical music does for you, that you still feel that you can jiggle it a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a big impulse for me in terms of why I like playing around with sound and also different genres is that I've always been a big believer that the change comes within. And I think I look at so many major institutions, especially major orchestras, and a lot of them are not always programming music outside of the standard canon. And I think there's many different reasons for that, but I really admire when an orchestra has a composer like next week down to be part of the community and to work with them, because a work like Black Band, I think, gives especially young audiences a chance to hear an orchestra and have an expanded idea of what an orchestra can be and do. And I think one of my favorite and most proud moments after hearing a performance of this piece is when I hear somebody say, wow, I didn't know an orchestra could do that, or I didn't know those stringed instruments could make a sound, like a guitar bend, or I didn't know all these kind of different things. And that's always been just that sheer sonic revelation, the ability to make people think differently about sound and what it can do and maybe what it might do that didn't happen in the piece, but further still, and to get everyone thinking a little bit like a composer. I think that's really my goal. And I find that by writing these pieces and working with kind of some of the more traditional institutions like major orchestras, instead of only doing really avant-garde pickup groups and galleries in Manhattan, I think that I'm able to communicate with a wide variety of people, and I'm also able to, hopefully affect some change or at least different perspectives within those traditional institutions, because I love Beethoven and Brahms, and there's some great traditional repertoire on the program. Coming up, some Stravinsky, I believe. But I think that those works are stronger and more interesting when they're located in the context of a larger variety of works, including what's being written today. There's different languages that have been evolving over time. It's no different than 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And I think that those are all things that are very important to me. And those aren't things that I can accomplish myself without partnering with an orchestra. It's somewhat subversive, the desire to go in to maybe slip something through the cracks that might be a little bit of a wilder sound.
Each work, when you feel you've completed it, does it have ideas that you want to play and do something else with that? That's sort of like a dragonfly. You're darting from idea to idea. And sometimes those ideas don't fit in the piece you're actually writing. You have to go and put it in a corner for a while and come back to it.
Absolutely. In fact, that is such a specific question. I'm so happy that someone asked me, because I have a very specific example of that. Sometimes I have, to put it in a maybe less judicious way to myself, I have ideas that are half-baked in one piece that are only fully realized later. And fortunately, there's more than one exclusive idea going on in the piece, so it can usually survive. But I had a piece recently called Lonesome Roads for Piano Trio, which is recorded on my Bridge Records album of the same name. And I'm very happy with the piece. But one of the ideas that I tried that maybe didn't work out as intended is I wanted to write the piece as a series of seven movements that could be played in any order, and to give the individual performing groups playing it some agency in what kind of story they wanted to tell. challenge, and it worked out really well. But one of the things I realized is that I had to put them in some kind of order in the published score. What ends up happening is, because that's a pretty decent order, a lot of groups that play it end up just doing it that way, or just decide that that's the, quote, best order. So in a sense, you know, it's not a piece that relies on that. It works very well otherwise, but that particular idea didn't really work as planned or come fully to fruition. However, it led me to take that thinking deeper, and I have a piece that I'm working on coming up called Unchained Melodies, and it's written for my ensemble in Chicago, Fifth House Ensemble, and we're a decktet that has a wind quintet, one of each of the four orchestral strings, and a piano, and I'm working on a piece now that is a collection of 10-minute solo pieces for each of those instruments. However, those pieces are written in a way that they can combine in any permutation with the other instruments for any kind of duet, any kind of trio, all the way up to a piece for the entire decktet. So this is, as you can imagine, an immense contrapuntal challenge, similar to the art of the fugue or something like that. But it's an idea that never would have occurred to me without an idea that was, you know, perhaps not quite as brilliant and not quite as fully realized. So each piece is definitely a vision of a particular story I want to tell, but it also usually has a private checklist of things that I want to write. It could be as simple as, I haven't written a fast rhythmic piece in a while. I want to do that. Or it could be an idea, like I just mentioned, something that's thematic or structural that I want to explore and that I'm not entirely sure will work. And I think I'm not very interested in writing pieces of music if I'm not trying to express something myself while also doing something that I'm not totally sure I could do.
It's like having something in the corner of your eye that's asking you to take attention to it, and you're not quite ready to do so. And all of a sudden, it'll come more fully fledged, and you can grab on to what the essence of it is and start to doodle with it.
Exactly. I mean, I spend so much time grasping in the wilderness, is what it feels like when I'm writing music. And right now, I'm writing a guitar concerto for the 2015 Grammy winner Jason Veo.
He's a wonderful guitarist. He came here years ago, yes.
Oh, good, yeah. He's so fantastic, and he's such a wonderful presence, you know, and he's an inspiration in itself just to write for. But that said, you know, my composing process when I started writing this piece for him wasn't to sit down with some ruled staff paper on day one and begin writing B-flats. It was very much about a month and a half process of sitting in the dark and just imagining what's the right idea for this piece? Because there's a lot of ideas that could maybe be okay, but what's just the right idea that Jason needs right now? What's the right combination? What kind of story am I ready to tell? What are the techniques that I've employed? How does the story unfold? And when I see enough of that clearly, then I can begin composing individual sections, and then I begin looking at how those work, and I reevaluate and revise. But it's definitely something that, for me, it's a process that moves from the vaguest kind of universal notions, and it gradually becomes more specific. And I think that's very distinct from the idea that we're often taught in classical composition, that you start with a small motive and then you immediately develop that and you manipulate that. I think that's something that does happen, but I think that there's something more important that's beyond that, which is figuring out what the overall drama of a piece of music is. And for me, that's a process that doesn't happen by letting a brick determine the shape of the house. It is involved in the piece as well. So maybe in classical music, we need to get away from some of the highly polished presentation ideas in terms of, we only show the finished product. Maybe what people really like to see is also some of this process that you and I are discussing now as well.
Work on it. I'd love to go to a performance of that quality.
Me as well.
Dan Visconti, composer in residence with the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra this season. His work, Black Bend, will be heard on the two Masterworks concerts next weekend, Saturday, January the 30th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday the 31st at 3 in the Maumel High School Performing Arts Center. The Sunday matinee performance is free for students K through 12 when accompanied by a ticket-holding adult. For tickets, call 501-666-1761 or online ArkansasSymphony.org. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.